last talk on the last session of the last day, or it says something like, let's bury him at the last session on the last day. Either way, what I'm going to describe is really, it's really more descriptive. And it's interesting that the dialogue around early Layton, because the issue is that as funding gets cut, all our abilities to maintain control programs get wiped out. And we have to, on the ground, really maintain focus on where transmission is likely to occur. So this tension and balance is a real issue. And I think what you brought up illustrates a real problem for us, is sustainability of control programs when it's driven by funding cycles. So how many know what this is? It's the myth of Tantalus. And so Tantalus apparently fed the gods, one of the gods, their children in a meal. And they cursed him, and they chained him up or buried him in water up to his neck, and he couldn't drink. Every time he'd go bend over to drink, the water would go down, and he had food over his head, and he couldn't reach the food either. So syphilis elimination, we were close. And I've given up on elimination. I think it's a failed concept. Now, we can go back several directors. I'm not going to read all of this, but Jeff Copeland really stressed when we kicked off syphilis elimination in 1999, why it was important. And the bottom part here is that even then we were talking about horizontal involvement in the community, meaning, you know, it needs to be involved with state and local health departments, community groups. And it's not just a difference in syphilis rates, but in a range of other health conditions that go hand in hand. And I guess what we'll come to at the end of this was that we focused on syphilis. And I think that was the problem, is that when you put syphilis out there as a lone funding source, even if we say it should be connected to broader community issues, it's easy for people to take the money away because it's only tied to one thing. We talk about community, but in reality, we were counting the number of cases. So 1998, CDC identified 28 U.S. counties that reported over 50% of primary and secondary syphilis cases. We had five of those in North Carolina, Forsyth, Guilford, Mecklenburg, Robeson, and Wake counties. We added Durham to that, where Duke University is located. Just thought I'd throw that in there, because it was neighboring several of our high morbidity counties. All six were targeted for elimination, and we were well on our way. Here are where the counties are located. I am going to focus a little bit more on Forsyth County, Winston-Salem, and you can see that Guilford County is right adjacent to Forsyth County. And this looks like it's a long way apart, but it's only about an hour, and there's an interstate that connects all of these counties to begin with, except for Robeson. Well, our syphilis elimination program started in 1999. The trend was actually that the number of primary, secondary, early, latent syphilis cases were coming down before then. The idea behind elimination was that if we really focused while the trend was coming down, that there was an opportunity to really drive this down, potentially eliminate it. And we did see historic low rates. In fact, in 2003, we had the all-time lowest number of cases reported in North Carolina since they kept track, or at least case rates. But what was happening sort of separate from all this was cuts in funds. And these arrows here refer to several key events. One was back in about 2002, 2003, we recognized an outbreak of HIV among young black MSM that were college students, which really reflected an ongoing issue within young black MSM communities in North Carolina. And it really took off rather dramatically. We had funding to investigate that. But at the same time, syphilis was beginning to go up nationally, and so we were starting to watch cutting of the syphilis elimination program. With success, you wind up losing funding rather than getting more support. Part of this funding effort here was also followed up with now a DEBI, the D-UP program, peer education and outreach for young black MSM to reach other young black MSM in harm reduction, risk reduction. We had that for a year in three sites, including Guilford and Wake counties. That was cut. It was competitive renewal. There was no continuation of the program so we could actually continue support within the community. I mean, these guys were really thrilled to have something that they viewed as their own, peer education, shown to be effective, and it was taken away, so that funding was cut. We also had a HRSA, a SPINS project, demonstration project, linking young black MSM who were newly diagnosed with HIV into care, with case managers working in the community. Again, part of the community doing outreach. So what was happening behind the scene here was our syphilis epidemic in the late 1990s was primarily heterosexual, crack cocaine driven, but minority. we were beginning to see emergence of higher risk activity in HIV within these very complex sexual networks for young black MSM, and our outreach and prevention efforts were being cut out from under us. So there's silo funding, and I'm not blaming anyone here. I'm not going to say that all this is money driven, but again, for coordinated activity, the funding sources were three different funding sources. And so there was no sort of communication across the board at the federal level on the impact at the community. And we had sort of the perfect storm. We tossed that around a lot. But an at-risk community with very complex, tightly connected sexual networks with syphilis not eliminated nationally. So we're sort of sitting there with no prevention dollars really going in on actually being cut at the same time that I think syphilis got introduced into these networks. Our concern was that the syphilis numbers were beginning to trickle up. We actually wrote a letter to CDC in 2007. Again, I'm not going to read all of this to you. I'm not here to bash folks at the CDC because I think it's a very complex issue. And frankly, there's a lot of stuff at the state that we now should go back and really look at to understand where did we mess up. Because I actually think you have to take responsibility, too, in public health when things aren't going well. And, you know, we said, look, it's great. We understand there's a limited amount of money and funds had to be redistributed, but there were issues around how that money was being distributed, and basically it was case-driven. And so there was a two-year period, but the problem is with syphilis, once it takes off in these networks, it takes off very rapidly. So we were setting ourselves up at a time where we had no syphilis, as I'll show you in Forsyth County, to having a slow response with increased funds as the cases start going up. And by the time you bring money in, it's a little late because it's really very well spread within the community. And we said, look, there's a lot of things that could be done. We'd like to know what the minimal number of resources should be, because honestly, I don't know what that is, to maintain sort of a lid in terms of prevention. What does it look like? What are the dollar funds, base funds that should be there? And again, this is something that health services program science really should be able to wrap around. And we threw out some ideas that maybe take into account the impact on syphilis and reducing HIV transmission, the geographic size of our area, because it's a pretty rural area with a large geographic content. And also, I would say that we probably should be looking at the impact in the broader community, and also what is the connectivity within the networks. So for us, where there's a larger sexual pool, a heterosexual network, it might take actually more time for HIV to transmit through the network than in black MSM networks, which are very small, very complex, in which because of the concurrency and overlap of, and change in partnerships, you can see very rapid spread. So it's not just considering number of cases, it's in the population whom you begin to see emergence of cases. And what happened was rather dramatic in that we had this trickling effect of syphilis cases, and then we had a doubling of our cases from 2008 to 2009. We had about 500 cases and we went up to nearly 1,000. And if you look at this in terms of funding levels, you can see that we had our peak funding in 2003. Funding was cut. We actually wound up with about an 80% cut in overall syphilis elimination funding in the state of North Carolina. And again, this trickle up with a rather dramatic increase in primary and secondary syphilis, primarily in the counties where we had our syphilis elimination activities to begin with. And where are they? Well, it's not terribly surprising. Mecklenburg, which is Charlotte, Forsyth County, Winston-Salem, Wake County, Raleigh is located there as well. But what was different is that the epidemic shifted. And so part of the, I think, learning lesson here was that a lot of the activities that were being done, one of the things we do in public health, we do something, once we implement it, we do it well and we do it often. But we're not necessarily so quick on changing what we're doing. Meaning evaluation, saying if you're not finding cases, maybe we should stop screening there and go somewhere else. And I think we didn't respond quickly enough. And what ended up happening is that we've had this increase in, a dramatic increase in MSM. But what should not be forgotten here is that its proportional increase is similar for what we're seeing in women. It's just that the number of cases are much greater and obviously the case rate is higher for men. The other part of this is that it is associated with HIV, which is what we're seeing nationally. In newly diagnosed cases of syphilis right now in North Carolina, about 50% are HIV infected. That compares to an historic sort of background level of around 5% back in 1998. So this is a real shift for us. And I actually think in our case, HIV preceded sort of the syphilis seeding within the network. Now we're watching this dual epidemic that's synergizing transmission. Well, let's kind of get a little bit more granular and look at Forsyth County. Forsyth County, at the beginning of syphilis elimination, had 54 cases of primary and secondary syphilis. Case rate was about 18.6. We launched the campaign. Funding peaked at about $170,000. We succeeded. We got down to one case of primary and secondary syphilis in 2003. Over a three-year period, they had eight cases. So it wasn't as if we weren't pursuing latent syphilis cases either. There just weren't very many syphilis cases in Forsyth County. But then things got cut, and basically all of the community piece was cut. There was a person at the health department who was able to sort of coordinate stuff and surveillance for community, but really didn't have all the bodies to be able to go out or money to probably really bring in stuff from communities. In the rural South, unless you have money you can bring into community organizations, they can't necessarily absorb more work, so it's a real issue. And our cases went up. I mean, we had 122 cases in 2009 and a case rate that went from 0.3 to 22 cases per 100,000. And this is what happened. Funding got cut. Cases had started coming up while the funding was going down. But again, the response with the formula, which again, I'm not saying this is all dollar driven, really wasn't able to adjust quickly enough to what is an epidemic. In addition, we lost jail screening for a little while here, partly due to funding, partly due to changes. But jail screening in our hands really, when we looked at it statewide, primarily identified women with early latent or latent syphilis rather than finding new male cases. So it made a lot of sense for heterosexual transmission, may actually be a good thing to do for surveillance standpoint for women, but not necessarily a good utility, especially for young black MSM, to pick up cases of syphilis. And of course, what happens, you institute these things, you put money, counties don't want to stop screening in jail. So I think, again, we're going to have to work from a process standpoint of how we actually improve flexibility within our programs. If we look at a 2 to 3 year snapshot, you can see at least 40-41% are men who have sex with men or men who have sex with both men and women. And that has shifted even more so that about 70% of our new cases now, even in Forsyth County, are occurring in MSM. And these networks are complex, and this is why I think we saw the takeoff. This is one diagram, not actually from Forsyth County, but one of our other counties in the state. And you can see this is a case of someone who is both infected with HIV and syphilis, and these are sexual partnerships. This individual is connected to multiple partners who are HIV infected, all newly diagnosed, so these aren't long-term infected individuals. These are the ages of the folks here, one of them 17 years old, but also connected to some folks here with lots of partners. This individual named 26 sex partners, this other one 9. So within these networks, connecting through the internet and text lines, you can see how HIV and syphilis spreads pretty rapidly in the population, and our response was too slow to the epidemic. I'm not really sure we could have had a faster response when you doubled your cases in a year, but we really need to develop, I think, better tools to pick up these takeoff points very, very early. So in summary, we did achieve syphilis elimination levels for heterosexual transmission, but without eliminating the underlying contextual factors contributing to health inequalities, in particular, the stigmatization, isolation of young black MSM in the South. We had silo funding, and our activities were very focused on syphilis. In fact, in North Carolina, we had to really push folks when they were doing syphilis screening. They weren't doing HIV testing. And it was one of these things was sort of like, I remember I had just become the medical director for the state, and I said, why aren't you doing HIV testing? So we get paid, this is the mindset, we get paid to do syphilis tests. And I said, well, you're drawing blood, aren't you? It goes to the state lab. Who cares? It matters to me that you do both. This is the same risk population. And it's that sort of thing, which again, there's a mindset of only focusing on the thing of which is the funding source and not putting into broader context. And I think we really have to look at a much broader coordination, not only at the community level, but prevention services targeting same populations really is going to have to require coordination, not just within CDC, but also CDC, SAMHSA, and HRSA. And I'm not exactly sure how that's going to occur, but this is sort of my plea and pitch to say that we really need that, especially since we're trying to get to the same populations through different mechanisms. So that's my talk. It's not all good, but I think it's not all bad in that We're here talking about it, and I do think we're in a different environment to have that kind of discussion, and these are the folks I'd like to thank for the data. I don't know if there's any questions or, yes.
Were you able to determine with your resurgence of syphilis whether it was because it was introduced back into your community from other areas, or do you know whether there was a resurgence of the syphilis that was already there?
It's hard to know. So the question was, I'm sure because you're in the back, everyone heard it, but I don't know if this is being recorded. So the question was, how do we know, do we know where how syphilis was reintroduced into the state or into the networks? Was it homegrown or from outside? I suspect it's a little bit of both. In some of our communities, they're relatively isolated, there's not a lot of travel, but in the counties that we're talking about, MSM community's pretty mobile, and we knew that there were outbreaks occurring up in D.C. and Atlanta at the same time prior to what happened in North Carolina. So I think we had syphilis introduced into the network from these other areas. And there's also a pretty active house and ball network up and down the East Coast that a lot of young black MSM move in and out of. And I think that that also was a contributing factor for syphilis transmission. The other part of this is that the medical community, when the numbers go down, forget syphilis. And you know, Laura Bachman's here. We both have experience where we have infectious disease or internal medicine clinicians not recognizing signs and symptoms of syphilis. And so it's a real issue, again, about making sure we have money for education for reemergence of disease that was missed.
I think you guys in North Carolina have been way ahead of the curve in a lot of ways that we at CDC have probably learned from. I'm wondering, with syphilis, kind of piggybacking on Dr. Kyle Bernstein's question of stages of syphilis and limited resources, that most transmission, from what I learned over the many years from people smarter than me, was that primary is really where most transmission occurs from exposure to a primary lesion, maybe 90%. And you guys are also doing DNA or NAT testing for HIV to get it early, acute HIV, to get people on antiretrovirals, lower viral load, hopefully transmission. Do you think that focusing on trying to get primaries identified, getting bisone in those people's behinds, and identifying HIV early may also be a way to get at core transmitters and stuff?
Yeah, so the question was the emphasis on transmission and what drives it. I really think that my take-home point is it depends on the stage of the epidemic. And so, ironically, when you drive your rates down, you create a, you know, the cyclical nature of syphilis is one of these things that people talk about. How much of it is part of herd immunity, how much of it is the growing up of a population at risk that hasn't had any syphilis exposure. And I suspect that what happened is we prolonged the downtime. We actually had a group of young men who there was almost no syphilis in that network initially, and so we introduced syphilis. Primary disease really drove it. And yes, I think if we got a lot more bicillin out in the community, we could have actually been ahead of the curve. What happens, though, is that with primary disease, especially if you're talking about MSM, people aren't connecting this or thinking about rectal lesions, oral lesions, and it gets missed. So unless they have secondary lesions and someone's astute enough to actually say that's syphilis, we delay getting treatment. In that small space, which is why I was concerned about the data about EIAs, if you miss primary syphilis when the numbers are small and you're looking at these networks, even if it's a few cases, but they're core transmitters, those first few cases are probably sentinel cases we have to be all over. It creates this sort of backlog, and you wind up staying behind the epidemic. So I really would like to see us talk more specifically around this for MSM and how do we really funnel a very rapid response, not looking at the bigger picture, but within these sort of micro networks.
And what I'd like to do is, I am the moderator,
yeah,
but I would
I've
like
ran
to
out of
make
time.
A comment.
Thanks.
No,
oh, go ahead.
No, you're good. I think this is good discussion. So I'm not kicking you off.
Getting yanked.
I'm the moderator. My name is Kevin O'Connor. I'm the chief of the program and training branch at the Division of STD Prevention, so I know a little bit about what you're talking, and I appreciate your thoughtful comments. And I'll just address the some of the money issues. So I arrived in the division in 2007, and we developed a new formula that was based on morbidity. And at that time, several project areas were still funded based on historic morbidity. There was much lower number of cases. We have a little more than $18 million in syphilis elimination dollars. So, you know, I know that North Carolina at that time had somewhere between $8,000 and $10,000 per case.
Right.
So, you know, if somebody wants to, Bill left, but if somebody wanted to look at how much money would it take for syphilis elimination, you know, when North Carolina and San Francisco and others were getting, you know, $8,000 to $10,000 per case, there was a lot more resources. When you look at the numbers and you look at the way things play out, we have increasing morbidity, but we have level funding. We have a funding formula that tries to allow jurisdictions with outbreaks to quickly become funded syphilis elimination areas. So for example, this year we've got five new high morbidity areas, but they get funding out of the same pie. So actually, you know, if North Carolina, for example, had the same number of cases, you would actually get reduced funding because there's more cases everywhere and there's more grantees because they've met those criteria. So as long as the morbidity keeps going up, the dollars get shorter for everybody, and it's really tough. You know, we looked at HIV is funded, I think it's the enhanced HIV funding. And that's a pretty specific criteria. I have to have, I think, 140 or 150 case rate of AIDS cases to get those dollars. And you know, it's hard to say this. We have 38 grantees for syphilis elimination funding, but we may be too generous with that. And we know that there's seven jurisdictions where over 50% of the PNS cases are. So, you know, it's a conundrum of, you know, with limited funds, what do we do?
Yeah, and I want to be very clear, because I don't think, and I don't want to give the impression, I think that it's the CDC's fault around right. money that this happened. I think there's a lot of things we can learn from it. What I would say is that I think that I've given up on the idea of elimination because it sets us up for the recurrent problem of either fixed funding or flat funding. And the idea that once the case rates go down, your cost per case obviously goes up. And at some point, people say, well, that's not sustainable. So you wind up cutting out the pegs around that. So unless there's some sustainable background to deal with that, it's just not possible. And I think I'd rather we talk about sustainability of just STD control programs, allowing more flexibility around that. So if we have a syphilis outbreak, I'm not saying we should stop doing chlamydia screening, but you know what? If you look at the cost benefit, maybe we should be moving some monies from other sources into this, because the payoff is enormous when you're looking at co-transmission of syphilis and HIV. So the quote for the tape is about, should performance measures be tied to primary syphilis, or should we be focusing more on it? The problem is, as we've already talked about before, is that primary syphilis is a difficult diagnosis to make. We have gaps in terms of dark field capability sort of gone. PCR is not available in any place unless it's a research tool, and the lesions are either completely missed or not recognized by clinicians because many of the guys that we have don't have primary care homes. So unless they're dealing with someone who's sort of used to dealing with STD-related issues, they go into EDs, and the last thing, if you get admitted to the hospital with a rash or anything, someone will look at your genitals. They forget that your genitals are attached to the rest of your body. So, you know, unless there's a catheter being put through it, it doesn't get any attention. And so it gets missed. So, you know, Laura and I have talked about this. We had a case of syphilis on the HIV service at UNC. A guy who was on meds, had a rash, and was discharged from our service that he had a drug rash due to his antiretrovirals. Was seen and follow-up in our clinic, and it turns out he had secondary syphilis. So it's not just that, you know, it's not the experts. I mean, I think we have to do some real education continuously around this. So maybe it's secondary syphilis or time to finding the cases. Again, I think you have to sort of match this thing with stage of epidemic and outcome measures, because if you don't have very many cases, then you want to really focus on latent, so you shift. But as you get this takeoff, if you're finding folks at secondary, that's great, but that means that you missed the primary lesion. We really have to figure out how to shorten the time, and we need better tools and technology to help us with this. Unfortunately, it's not going to be easy to do. It's easy to say.
Sorry, Peter, could you tell us how you managed to juggle this reduction in funding to go out to appropriate community-based organizations who largely deal with either initially a heterosexual epidemic and then one which is really escalating amongst MSM?
Well, so the way we've juggled this or tried to move resources is that we've used some of our HIV resources. So where we're doing HIV testing, we insist that you have to do syphilis tests, and we've been able to get the state lab to buy into that. We've been trying to work by going out and talking to HIV providers, because there's such an overlap here, and you've heard it over and over again that they're not doing routine screening, that they should be doing routine screening. We are still working in communities. Unfortunately, not all counties have great community relationships. Folks from Wake County here work very closely with the community and have adjusted to that to work with the CBOs. So again, it's moving out and trying to adjust to that, but we've used HIV resources basically to pay for lots of syphilis activities in the state. And we view them as one and the same. We're an integrated program. I know you've been having your hand up, and we...
Yeah, I said the same thing. I mean, I know funding is an issue too, but what you just said is true, because in Houston, we had the same problem as syphilis elimination, but at that time, when I recall the syphilis elimination, you know, we were challenged with developing surveillance programs, rapid response, and then health education and medical providers, so that when we do have these outbreaks in the future, we'll be able to jump on them and respond quickly. And if it works perfectly, you know, we can keep it down. And I know in Houston it didn't work perfect, because we saw the same thing that happened there after we had syphilis elimination. Last year, 2 years ago, we were like number two in the nation. But I think we did have some things in place that allowed us to respond once we did see the numbers go up, like the health education networks. We had PAMS Texas, where we were able to go on and talk to all the doctors in the Houston area to let them know that the syphilis cases were rising again. We have a network, we have an integrated program with HIV, so we have the CBOs and HIV prevention who have to squad in the area and also control syphilis in those population growths high. I mean, it got high, and we're number two in the nation, but we were quickly able to put those activities into place, which we established during syphilis elimination, to get the numbers back down again. So I think what's important, I know funding is a key issue, but in the initial part of syphilis elimination, there were some key components that were asked to be put in place, like rapid response, health education, and then surveillance, that I think if, the thought was that we know that syphilis is in the population, that it would be probably going to get some outbreaks later.
Yeah.
But if you had these things strongly developed, and they responded quickly, you could outbreaks.
Well, and I know Tom Stoller, Tom Peterman, so the part of it too is that we've had and we're in a process of reevaluating what is it DIS do and what can they stop doing, and it's a real, there's not a whole lot of data out there, so this is sort of gut feeling and discussions. I mean, what do you do with the reactor grid? What's the utility of actually going after latent syphilis cases when you got all these primary and secondary cases? Should we be dealing with control measures? You know, North Carolina has control measures around HIV, and so we're finding, you know, 50% of the syphilis cases are HIV infected. I'll tell you my own bias. I don't think that control measures really impact behavior a whole lot, so I'm not a big fan of it. But it takes up a lot of time for our DIS if they have to go after folks and do counseling. I'd rather have the local health department do it and have the DIS do the field work. In addition, we probably need to have better ways of actually listening to what the field service folks hear, whether they're community-based or state-based. Their ears and eyes pick up stuff a lot earlier than the numbers do. So I'd like for that to sort of be something we sort of allow more trickle up and direct feedback. I don't know how much time we have
left. We've got about 3 minutes.
Okay.
I did the syphilis surveillance for the state of Connecticut, and we're very sensitized for a small state. But we had 105 cases of early syphilis last year, which is didn't quite make syphilis elimination funding. We have been working, and I call all the physicians to find out why they did the blood tests and all of this as part of my work. And for the last 2 years, I've been encouraging our syphilis, our HIV clinics, please, test your sexually active guys regularly, because they were testing once a year. We've got most of them testing at least every 6 months. Some of them, if they know that the patients are very sexually active, they test every time they come in the clinic. We're catching an awful lot of early latent cases, no symptoms, but we know they're a reinfection. Just by doing that, if you can get the HIV doctors to work with you, you can catch an awful lot.
Yeah, I think this idea of getting HIV providers to actually think about STDs, not in a judgmental way, but sort of recognize that, you know what, whether you're HIV positive or negative, you're going to have sex. So let's just get over that and make sure that we're screening folks. But the problem you get into is that different states have different approaches around this, and I worry a great deal about the criminalization of HIV, so that it actually acts as a barrier for screening, testing, and treatment. May not be an issue in Connecticut, but we have a lot of pushback even at the local level, and I think it's something we need to, again, have more dialogue about. But I agree with you. It's the providers in this case for folks that are connected. For us, we have, you know, an unemployment rate that's 11%, uninsured rate of 25-28%, and so a lot of our young black MSM have no health provider at all. So they're outside of the system, and EDs are an awful place for diagnosis of syphilis, because even if they make the diagnosis, they don't typically have benzathine penicillin, so you wind up getting a referral for somewhere else for treatment.
Let's take one more question.
Yes.
In any of your cases, do you find any connection, like inside of Charlotte, that your syphilis, your primary, the secondary syphilis is coming from another state?
Well, that was sort of asked earlier, and we do see connections more and more to Atlanta and to D.C., for cases right now for a young black MSM. Usually just not everyone's moving, but there's a couple of core people that are connected. And so I think that, again, more regional sort of antennas to say what's going on and looking at these connections are going to be critical. What to do about it is a whole other story, because we don't tend to have regional activities around control. I think the CDC is interested in trying to develop more and more of that, but I think for MSM populations that's really critical, because it's a very mobile population.
You mentioned that Bald House.
Yeah.
Yesterday, that was the first time I ever heard of that, and they have like these societies in all these major cities, and you said it has a connection with the MSM and a ratio of a high infection there with the HIV, and these organizations they mentioned yesterday that some of these are having like sex parties.
Well, I mean, some of them are, some of them aren't. I mean, you can, you know, I think that, again, it's an organization we'd like to try to, or groups that we should try to work with for education. And I think that that's an important way of doing outreach. So I don't think that they serve, there's a lot of other things besides sex that goes on anywhere for any group of people. And part of the reason why these exist is that a lot of the guys that we see have nowhere to go. They get kicked out of their homes, they're not accepted in the community, and they get taken into a place where they're provided food, shelter, and some support. So I think understanding what's going on there is critical. But I'm gonna stop. I'd be happy to stick around for questions. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you, Peter.